Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the Horrid Halls of Academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back for another semester of the Faculty of Horror.
I missed you.
We missed you. We missed you so much. But while we were away, we were thinking of you guys a lot.
A lot.
A lot. So we have a couple announcements we want to do off the top before we get into the episode at hand. That is, of course, next month in October, October 5th, we will be in Salem for the Salem Horror Fest. I will be doing a lecture midday on social media and horror films. And then that night, we will be doing a live episode on Under the Skin. Very excited about that.
Me too. We've been planning this a long time. I've been thinking hard about this film. And this film, there's a lot to think about.
There's a lot to think about, and you'll think better about it if you're there. If you've been following Salem Horror Fest on social media, you know that among some of the other events, our live show is pretty close to selling out. If you are thinking about it, if you are in the area and you want to go, get your tickets now. They're really reasonable. Don't sleep on it, and make sure you get into the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have another announcement.
Yeah, this one's a pretty big deal, too. And I'm not going to say you guys asked for it, but you guys definitely inspired us to do this. You've been very generous with your donations over the years. Alex and I have always been committed to providing this podcast free of charge. We want you to be able to access this, and that's always going to be the case as long as Faculty of Horror is a thing. However, you guys are also clamoring for more content. And now that we have finally been able to outsource editing duties from me, thank you, Danny Lindsay, we can offer a Patreon full of perks and extra content and stuff for our most ambitious listeners.
So our Patreon will be launching when this episode drops. So the link to it will be in the show notes. We won't go into great detail about it right now because if you're interested, if you're keen, you can go read about it and see all the cool stuff we have going on. But if that's not in your budget, if it's not something you're interested in, if you're just here for the lols, this is still Faculty of Horror. We will be producing full-length episodes.
Every month.
Every month, all the time. And it's really exciting. So if you want to, please join us over at Patreon. We're really excited. We've got some really cool stuff coming up.
Yeah. And we want to thank you again for all the generous donations have been amazing. We want to be able to give something back. So this is our attempt at doing that. But the show will always be free and we value you very much.
Yeah. And hopefully you can hear it because starting this episode, we have a brand new mic.
How do we sound, guys?
I swear to God, if we don't sound good, I'm going to burn this place to the ground.
Maybe it's the Haunted Manor.
It could very well be the Haunted Rumored Manor.
Well, not much we can do about that.
No. But speaking of haunted places,
nice.
Let's get to this month's episode, Nobuhiko Obayashi's House. And of course, House, but it's the opening. I can't help but think about this film within the spectrum of the world that this film creates.
That's right.
It's, you know, so exciting. It's so vibrant. It's so weird.
It makes me feel like I'm on drugs.
Meow! Like, who knows what's going to happen? So, yeah, this was one that I came to only a few years ago, and it was because when we did our 31 Days of Horror for Faculty of Horror on our website, Andrea picked this one as her, like, go-to watch on a Halloween night, I think a couple years back. So then, of course, on one Halloween night a couple years back, I decided I will watch it, and I fell in love with it. I can't believe that I didn't get to see it before, and really, in North America, we only got access to this film back in about 2010 when Criterion released it.
Mm-hmm. And they released a beautiful, beautiful edition that I thought I had, but I couldn't find. It apparently has some really amazing special features I was reading up on that I wasn't able to find. So
it also has Ty West.
Yee-hoo! So influential. But yeah, I came to this movie several years ago. I remember I had a roommate at the time, and we threw it on after a night of drinking. Like, I don't know what we were thinking, that we were just going to watch this weird fucked up movie when we were drunk and dead tired. And I was falling asleep and I was drifting in and out of sleep. And I'd see a snippet of the movie and I'd be like, I've got no idea what the fuck's going on. I've got to watch this again later. And I watched it again later and I still had, it's so weird when you fall asleep during the movie and you feel disjointed about it and then you watch it and actually find it that disjointed. So I'd seen it twice before. This was time number three, and it just gets better and better. I dare say that obviously my first watch wasn't great, but my second watch, it's hard to get on board. It's hard to steel yourself against all the insanity that comes at you. And I feel like it's only on the rewatch when you kind of know the basic bones of the story and you can let yourself experience it mm-hmm. that you really do.
So while this film is as trippy and as experimental and has been described in a myriad of ways, there is some really concrete, interesting themes at play. There's some real darkness to this story. There's some real lightness to this story. And that's what we're going to dive into today. And without further ado, this is
House.
House.
Sweet. 私はあなたを救えなかった。
I see in your eyes where tomorrow is hiding in my heart. There's a bell ringing loud at the touch of your lips. Down the rainbow I'm sliding. Little arrows keep falling as thick as a cloud.
After her father brings home a new girlfriend, teenager Gorgeous contacts her estranged aunt and asks if she and her friends can visit her in her countryside home. Gorgeous and her friends Fantasy, Prof, Sweet, Kung Fu, Mac, and Melody, and of course the cat Blanche, arrive at the aunt's remote house, finding it in disrepair and Auntie to be quite weak. The house becomes a malevolent force, consuming the girls as the aunt grows strong and possesses Gorgeous. The remaining girls fight for survival, but are ultimately doomed as Auntie retains control of Gorgeous. Ryoko, Gorgeous's father's girlfriend, arrives at the house intent on bonding with Gorgeous, but the film implies that she will wind up yet another victim of the house.
House.
Meow?
So, right off the bat, interestingly enough, the version that I saw had Gorgeous's name subtitled as Angel.
Oh.
And rather than, did you say Blanche?
Yeah.
I had, it was either Snowball or Snowflake or
some
Snowy.
Some kind of white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, however you might have heard these characters translated, it pretty much amounts to the same thing. But what's super interesting about this film, there's a lot interesting about this film, but I think what's most interesting about this film is its origin story, in that its writer was tasked with providing the production studio another Jaws.
Yeah, so that is, of course, the director Obayashi, and this is where we can talk a little bit about Japanese cinema. So, post-World War II, the 1950s and 1960s were seen as the golden age of Japanese cinema, with auteurs like Akira Kurosawa. But by the 70s, it collapsed. This whole film industry collapsed with shrinking audiences and studios going out of business. And this was in part due to the stranglehold of American blockbusters. So we've talked about the kind of Hollywood new wave, the new era ushering in the 70s, where, you know, you had things like Easy Rider, but you also had films like Star Wars. And of course, the aforementioned Jaws. And in 1975, the year Jaws was released, American films outgrossed Japanese films in Japan for the first time ever. So the remaining studios were, you know, rightfully nervous. They're more quote-unquote well-made films, the kind of prestige films that they were producing weren't flying the way they used to anymore, and they needed to recalibrate because there's a new generation, there's a new audience, there's an audience with different goals and wants and needs, and you have to adapt to that. So, as Andrea said, House started as a response to Jaws.
So, Obayashi, who had gained crazy notoriety for really bizarre TV commercials, did you catch any of these on YouTube?
I didn't. I just saw that he worked with the likes of Kirk Douglas and Charles Bronson, and I saw a couple stills, and that was enough for me.
I saw the Charles Bronson one. He's a cowboy out in the Wild West, you know, out in the wild, and he's got his bottle of perfume. He's got his several perfume bottles all lined up, and he's like playing Texas Hold'em against them, and he's like throwing cards, and they're like landing on the bottles perfectly erect, like stop motion trickery, totally bizarre, totally surreal. So Obayashi was a respected experimental filmmaker. So for Toho, the film company, to approach him to come up with a story for a film like Jaws, for which he consulted his preteen daughter. The screenplay was written by someone else, but they came up with this story, and the script was greenlit, but the project languished in limbo for 2 years because nobody wanted to direct it. None of the in-house directors at Toho wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole, but all this time, Obayashi was hustling it. He was hustling radio dramas. He was making successful manga. There was merch out before this movie even existed. And all of that went so successfully that Toho agreed to let him direct it. So this is like so, you know, Jaws is kind of anything but a cinematic risk. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was a huge blockbuster, but it was also kind of a
straightforward.
Yeah, it was pretty doomed to succeed, so to speak. Similarly, Houseu was a box office hit, but reception was pretty negative in its native Japan, and it got better reviews in North America upon its release later on in 2009.
But it was a hit in Japan. It did really well at the box office.
Box office hit, negative critical reception.
Yeah, and I think that's important to kind of counter with. And this is something I don't think we've really talked about on the podcast, but the notion of the critical establishment, you know, film critics. And this is something that is, you know, talked about, I think, a lot more now in the industry. And Andrew and I have talked a lot about this between ourselves, as we're both, you know, film critics and writers. And we used to be younger, and now we're youngish women trying to break into film criticism. And there's the old guard, and there's always going to be an old guard, quote unquote, no matter what industry you get into. And so I think here we have that disparity of generations. You know, you have the kind of established film critics who write for the certain outlets in Japan, and they all had one take on it, and it's basically a WTF. What the hell is this film? What the hell is going on? Yet you had this audience that was making up the huge financial gap that Japanese studios were experiencing. There was a huge influx of female audience goers to this film. This is constantly what we see when we see audience reports about horror, that women go not only as much as men, but often more than men to go see horror films. You know, so we're starting to see that trend of this other generation picking up the mantle and wanting to move forward and experience something fun and interesting that is weird and different and can only be a cinematic experience. I mean, you know, part of what I was reading about Obayashi utilizing his daughter's imagination was that he felt these ideas and her nightmares and whatever she was telling him was so cinematic. And it was so pure. And I think that's what resonates on screen. And when you have these kind of brilliant, whatever you think of them, if you don't like them, prestige films, but, you know, Kurosawa does what he does, and he does it very, very well, but it is very different from House. But both films, both creators should be at play
in
this industry. Otherwise, we're just making the same shit over and over again.
But that's true. And then there's also, you know, the color all around it. Like I said, there was a whole bunch of merch. Obayashi also employed models that he worked with for his commercials. So there was, you know, a certain glamour, a certain fashion element. The Japanese cosmetic industry is like one of the biggest in the world. So these were recognizable faces, but that you weren't used to seeing on the big screen. There were a number of reasons why people went to see this film, and they did. And Obviously, the what the fuck factor is valid and absolutely valid. And, you know, Obayashi, I did get to see an interview with him that I found on YouTube that I'll stick in the show notes because holy shit, he is so cute. Did you see anything of the like?
I don't think so. I saw a brief clip, but
he is very, very playful. And he really reminded me of, I interviewed Severin Fiala and Veronica Franz recently because they did Goodnight Mommy, which we did an episode on. And I interviewed them recently about The Lodge, and they were talking about how much they love to work with children because children just come at it from such a pure place of, tell me what to do and I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And this is almost the flip side of that, where their imagination is so unfettered. I really got the sense that Obayashi really just wanted to play and just wanted to say, you know, like, what scares you in the most primal, innocent, reactionary way? And this is what we came up with.
Yeah, and I think that in some ways, House is one of the worst films to do on a podcast because we are an audio medium, unless you're one of those weird video podcasts and I don't understand what it is you do. But for, you know, the 99.9% of audio podcasts out there, when I talk about the film, it's so traditional. You know, these girls, these virginal girls go to this house and the house is haunted and then the house attacks them and it kills them. You know, it's not that outside of the realm of the norm. And a lot of where it comes into play in terms of the outlandishness of it is some of the situational stuff, which we'll talk about, but then also the visuals. We will never be able to recreate or describe properly the visuals for you. So we'll find some stuff to put in the show notes to kind of illustrate some of them. You know, there are screen grabs and all of the articles. If you're not familiar with this film, please go check it out so that you can see this madness for yourself, because I promise you it is worth it. But as we are the faculty of horror and as we are wont to do, I think we need to kind of start at the base of what this film is. And I think, you know, it alludes to what Andrea was talking about earlier. Coming to this film this time with a critical eye and an analytical eye to watch this film, it's different because the last few times I've seen it, it's just kind of washed over me. Mm-hmm. And I've been like, that's interesting. And I've always been like, oh, there's other stuff going on in this film. Mm-hmm. Like, there's layers to this film.
But it's too much. It's too much all at once.
So this time going in with it, I really had that in my mind. And for me, what I come away with is that this film is about a generational divide. And it is about the kind of fractured matriarchy which society creates, because this is not a new thing to horror, but the characters are so predominantly women. And my initial notes when I did a first pass at this and just was watching the film and took some notes, one of my notes is, men's promises are shit, question mark. But it is this, you know, we've got a dead mother, a young girl searching for a connection, wanting to reject her father, who is a new girlfriend, going to her aunt, you know, finding camaraderie among her friends, losing that camaraderie, and then, you know, finding this kind of almost like a prison sentence in this house, waiting out as this kind of possessed ghost thing. So to me, it reads as this, you know, source of female power and how patriarchy, maybe a small p in this term, the father goes on and, you know, it's like, I love my daughter, but I have a new girlfriend and this is my career and I'm doing my thing and la, la, la. And yet you've got these women who are so disparate from each other, but need or want to connect with each other, maybe even eat them or possess them. Still a form of connection. And you've got this strange story about the lack of power and opportunity provided to women so that when they come together, it doesn't work. And it kind of falls apart.
Very interesting.
And that's just my read.
Yeah. My read is similar but different. Definitely generational divide. Definitely, definitely. And I totally agree that every time I watch this film, I pick up on more little details, on more little hints, and I start to lose that sense that it's washing over me, and I feel like I'm really finally kind of getting a grasp on it. This one was tough, though, and I was researching it right up until today, and it's still a bit of a slippery fish in my hand. I saw in a review, they referred to the film as a fever dream from a young female imagination. And I kind of tried to bend my head around that. And the more I thought about it, I was like, you know, it's not, I don't feel like it's a childish gaze. I don't feel like it's a childhood perspective. I feel like it feels like a memory. It feels like when you've been through anything, it could be a traumatic event, but any memory from your childhood, when you think back to it, you don't remember how things looked or like what was on the table in front of you per se. You remember how you felt and you remember kind of what happened in the most simple terms. Exactly. And I feel like this film, you know, some of the lines, some of the script are so stark and simple. And just really straightforward. And then the settings and the visuals are almost caricatures of themselves. Like they're walking out of a postcard because you just know it was in the country somewhere. It doesn't matter, you know?
One of my favorites is Ryoko, the father's girlfriend, and the wind machine, the constant
always
wind
blowing
machine
in the
and her
wind.
Own music. Yeah. And it's perfect.
She is just glamour personified.
And that's how you would see as a child. Oh. Like that's how you see a beautiful, you know, mature adult woman.
Or how you would remember it,
yes,
that she was
exactly.
just so glamorous. So I feel you on that. Definitely the generational divide, definitely, but like also a sense of memory. And I feel like that generational divide has to do with the war that I think we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about Hiroshima. We're going to talk about the transition from childhood to adulthood. And something that I've really been grappling with regard to this film is why, you know, I feel like the film is telling us, you know, don't forget suffering. Don't forget trauma, lest we are doomed to repeat it. However, when we're faced with the figure of Auntie, it's just kind of like, why would you want to wreak vengeance on the next generation rather than impart your pain? Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
It's something that I kind of struggled with, and I've got a lot of thoughts, and I've got a lot of notes, and I can't wait to discuss it with you.
Yeah, I think we're going to dive into notes and theories and different things like that, but, you know, I think it's, once you experience trauma, it's hard to forget it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I certainly have adult or more adult figures in my life, or did when I was growing up, who were constantly relating trauma to me.
Mm-hmm.
This happened to me. This is why I'm like this.
Yeah.
Listen, listen, listen. And so now you've got, I think, in house almost a kind of extrasensory experience of trauma.
Yeah.
And it works.
Like the way the soundtrack changes.
Oh, yeah.
The soundtrack can effectively suck the air out of a room in a way that you can't visually depict.
Absolutely. And each character has their own score or soundtrack. You know, like every time Kung Fu gets a moment, it switches to the Kung Fu music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Kung Fu's pretty epic.
I love Kung Fu. She's my favorite.
Is she your favorite? Is she the one you think you would be if you were sent to this house?
No, I'd probably be like fantasy. Or I'd be the cat.
You would totally be the cat.
I'd so be the cat.
I'd be Mac, except I really don't like watermelon.
You don't?
I don't like any melon.
That's fair.
All right. So we mentioned a little bit before that the Second World War plays a big part in this film, in what it is, in how it's received, and in the message it's imparting, at least to me and Alex, but I've read up elsewhere that it plays a big role. Now, basically, when I was coming to this film, I needed information about women in Japan, what it was like to be a Japanese woman in Japan. You know, we talked a little bit about J-horror, we talked about Battle Royale, and we've talked about The Ring, and that was kind of in a certain era. And this film takes place in an era where Japan was in transition, and especially with regard to women. So my research on women in Japan pre-World War II just was not all that different from traditional conceptions of women here in the West. They were expected to stay at home. They were expected to be strong wives and mothers and reproduce the labor that kept the capitalist machine alive, basically. However, in Japan, it went a little bit further than that. I was reading up that ideally three generations lived under the same roof and women were known to occupy, quote, three submissions, which is to say daughter submits to father when you're young, wife submits to husband, and elderly moms submit to their sons as the leaders of the household. And Alex is making a face. You're probably making a face. I'm making a bit of a face. I really don't want to judge other cultures. I think patriarchy is a pile of shit no matter where you are in the world, but this is what my research yielded. Male heads of households with only daughters would adopt male heirs to succeed them, often through arranged marriage. And more than half of all marriages in Japan were preemptively arranged until the 60s. And that was something that the movie kind of snagged with me. Is remember the gym teacher?
Yeah.
I think she was the phys ed teacher who was about to say, yes. Oh, have a nice holiday, girls. Oh, but you have a nice holiday. You're getting married, right? Yeah, it's an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
And you really get the sense that she's just like, fuck, this next generation doesn't have to deal with this shit. This next generation. Anyway, we'll come back to that. Japan had strong cultural expectations with regard to behavior, stuff like modesty, courtesy, compliance, but motherhood was a really big one for pre-war Japan. And an interesting discovery was that, like, when I talk about bento boxes, what do you think about?
Sushi restaurant.
Yeah, a sushi restaurant. It's an offering that's like, you know, it's kind of a almost a variety pack. Mm-hmm. You know, there'll be some sushi, there'll be some noodles. There's often like some tempura, like an appetizer type thing. So bento boxes became a trend for women to provide elaborate and aesthetically pleasing lunches for their kids to take to school. And that was actually kind of a status symbol. It was expected that women would, you know, like the night before be preparing and the morning of be preparing these elaborate obento boxes for their kids to take to school. And I also learned that Japanese coverage of crime at this time often featured women apologizing for the crimes of their sons. So the role of motherhood extended all the way to adulthood. When you were beholden, you were responsible for a person if you created them, mm-hmm. and you were responsible for your household if you were part of it. And again, I'm not casting judgment.
No.
But I thought this stuff was just really fascinating.
Well, and it's hard because I think, you know, when you describe it, I'm imagining worst case scenario. But I think there is a nobility to that and, you know,
I think it was a very proud tradition
yeah.
that a lot of women took a lot of pride in. And I think that, you know, I'm into Marxist feminism. I'm all about elevating the labor of women done in the household. Mm. And that's something that features very strongly here. So then, you know, like, this is what it's like. Japan is doing its thing. And then the war happened. And toward the end of the war, well, pretty much what caused the end of the war was an atomic bomb. Two atomic bombs, actually. August 6th and 9th, 1945, the U.S. detonated two nukes over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing between 130,000 and 226,000 people, mostly civilians. And the effects lingered. I think we're all kind of reeling from
Chernobyl.
Chernobyl show. Radiation, leukemia, and various cancers among the survivors occurred. And basically, after that, Japan surrendered. The surrender was a huge shock to the Japanese, who were confident that military victory was inevitable. And as a result, drug and alcohol abuse became big problems, gangs and prostitution. And there was a sense of despair that was so prevalent that it got its own term. It was termed the Kyodatsu condition, which is to say the state of lethargy. So things were bad. But then when the occupation ended, sovereignty was restored in 1952, with the exception of the Ryukyu Islands, who were occupied until 72. But anyway, the occupation actually did some good to Japanese women in that it brought over feminism, but it brought over American feminism that didn't entirely apply to the Japanese context. I mean, of course it did. Women in Japan were recognized as having equal rights to men after World War II. They only gained the right to vote in 1947, and that was 2 years following Hiroshima. And other post-war reforms included equal pay for equal work, although women still earn less and occupy lower income gigs. Da 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 da, just like here, just like everywhere. Right. Anyway, still, this was a really rocky transition. Like, during the war, it was popular and encouraged to reject anything American. And so you're going from these really traditional ways of life to having all these rights, and socially, it caused a bit of a rift. Like, feminist groups started to form in 1970, but the contraceptive pill was only legalized in 1999. And so that's just to say that this was a period of very, I don't want to say confused, because I don't want that to sound derogatory, but
mixed messages?
Yeah, it had to find its footing, which it very much did. However, I feel like this film is, having learned all this, this film is really a snapshot of the growing pains mm-hmm. of getting to point A to point B.
Yeah, and there's a really great episode of a BBC history podcast that I'll link in the show notes. It talks about the evolution of Japan's modern era. And in this podcast, they talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki as the most tragic kind of do-over for Japanese culture, that this
reset button.
Exactly. It was a reset button. Again, the most tragic reset button you could ever have.
Yeah.
And one that no one should ever want or need. But there's this breaking point where they could have reinvented, and they did to a certain extent, their entire culture and way of living.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of took on some, you know, according to this podcast, they took on some new Western influences, as Andrea was describing, but they remained kind of center-right in terms of their politics. So there's still the kind of individualism, the kind of strong work ethic, the base, the backbone of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the stuff we really dug into in our Battle Royale episode, I believe. But there were so many influences at this time. And where they wound up was not that far away from where they were. In some ways when the war started, even though there was the influence of democracy and some changes politically. But, you know, in the 50s and 60s, Japan had an economic boom. They were doing really well. And then this all crashed in the early 70s. But in this period, you had Japan living and working in a certain way, and it was working for a lot of people. However, you had these artists who were completely radical and divisive, and they wanted to be. And, you know, among those artists were people like Yoko Ono, and among them were people like the director of House, Obayashi, who partook in, you know, demonstrations and artistic interventions to create conversation, but also destabilize narratives that the government was forcing on its people, where they were saying, everything's fine, everything's fine. And there was another instance of this kind of attitude in Japan recently, back in 2011 with the Fukushima nuclear disaster, which is second only to the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And it was caused when an earthquake caused a rupture in a nuclear power plant. And the government said, everything is fine, everything is fine, everything is fine. And people are still questioning the after effects. What is safe? Are there radiation clouds over us right now?
Oh, my God.
You know, so some artists have spoken out about it, but there is a certain amount of government control that is happening.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, make no mistake, looking up analyses of this film, it's about the bomb.
Oh, yeah.
It's about the war. That much is kind of unanimous. I saw this stupid video. I'm not going to link it in the show notes because it was stupid. But it was marketed to me as, you know, watch this video and you'll never watch Haosu the same again. And it's like, it's about the bomb. And the flashes in the cat's eyes are the bomb. And I was like, no, no. That is not at all enough to talk about this film. Because I do get the sense that this is a very conscientious, radical filmmaker who had an opportunity. And there's a lot of what the fuck in the film. There's a lot of what the fuck about the film. As you said, this was a time where film companies were in decline. This was not a time to take a crazy expensive experimental risk. But they did, and this is what came out of it. And it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of art that says a lot, as far as I can tell.
And it's a nimble, what is it, like 88 minutes?
I think for a film that bizarre, had it been any longer, it would have been exhausting.
Yeah.
Exactly. It was perfect. It was perfectly paced, in my opinion.
And so for Obayashi, where the bomb kind of fit into the development of it is obviously he talked to his daughter a lot and pulled a lot of stuff from her and her nightmares and what she was thinking about. And you can see it in the almost fairy tale-like structure of this film. But then he wanted to add in the layer about Hiroshima because, you know, he lost his friends in those bombings. He lost people he knew. And he was of the age where he was the generation that was deeply affected by the bombs. So he added that as a layer in, and I think that's where you get this kind of generational tension. Even if it's not completely overt or it wasn't intentional, you have a creator, a film creator, who has grappled with this bomb, this absurd, unimaginable thing that happened. And he wanted to capture it filmically, but he also incorporated his daughter's thoughts.
Her anxieties, really, her fears.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the absurdity, because I think the absurdity was kind of the point, is that a bomb killing a bunch of civilians is fucking absurd. It is senseless, senseless violence. It is violence for the sake of violence, and it's not targeting people who are making these decisions. And like I said, I've seen footage of Obayashi talking about it, and he gets very emotional. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, this is not light reading.
And I think in the film, it's so interesting because when they talk about Auntie's fiancé who goes off to war and doesn't come back, and that's where the kind of talk of the bomb happens. So when it goes into this memory, when it goes into her history, it turns into almost a silent film, kind of turns into a newsreel for a little bit.
They're commenting on it.
And they're commenting on it.
I love that, that meta-ness, that...
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, this very kind of clear, because again, Obayashi shoots it like a silent film, exactly like a silent film. So you can follow along just the visuals and the screen cards. And then you have these young girls commenting on it. And of course, you know, one of the things that people always reference is when one of them says, it looks like cotton candy.
Cotton candy. Yeah. The cloud.
When you see the cloud, the nuclear cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is such a critical point because you realize the disconnect. You go from a generation consumed by this trauma, like deeply, deeply traumatized by it, to their children or their children's children able to say, it looks like a fluffy piece of candy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, where the heart of this film lies.
That's right.
Is that liminal space in between those two things.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, you know, Auntie's story is fucking tragic.
It is.
It's tragic. She loved someone. Again, to reference back to the earlier teacher, this was not an arranged marriage from what I could tell. And she loved this man. He went off to war and he never came home.
Yeah. And it was almost like there's no shade on him. There's no like, you know, there was no, he should have dodged that draft or he should have, like, no, he was a brave man who went and did his duty. And
her grief is so consuming that she dies waiting for him and then has to take another body to continue to wait for him.
It poisons her and it curses her. And this is something that I really struggled with in my analysis of this film, and something that I kind of continue to struggle with in all this research I've done on Japan and women, that there just seems to be this reappearance, much more so in J-horror, which comes later in Japanese cinema history, but these jilted, vengeful women who have been wronged and just want to impart that wrong elsewhere. And, you know, when it comes to Ringu, which we've talked about, when it comes to The Grudge, which we may talk about, you know, it's a... they're inflicting it on other people who kind of get caught in their web. But when it comes to Auntie, this is her kin. This is her lineage. This is the closest thing to the child that she never got to have. And I kind of struggled to reconcile why this vengeance, what it all means and where I stand in it.
Well, do you want to hear my weird theory?
Do I? I'm going to refill my wine first and yours as well. And then we're going to go there.
I can't tell if I like this wine or I hate it. Okay.
Yes.
Here's my theory about House.
Hit me.
Auntie died in the bombings.
Died in the bombings. Okay.
Again, I don't know where they are in Japan. I don't think it's ever really... Unfortunately, my geography of Japan isn't great. And I don't think it's super clear where the house is. They just have to go to the countryside it. And for me, that kind of plays into what I was mentioning earlier about the matriarchal side of this film. And it's about the kind of lost lineage of women.
Mm.
Auntie either, you know, maybe, who knows, died in the bombs or just died of grief. And she lost the ability to kind of create her own family or narrative or a kind of familiar structure that carried on a kind of legacy or lineage.
Okay. Given what my research yielded about Japan and its obsession with women as mothers, that actually makes a lot of sense, that this woman be not only jilted, that she did not, you know, her love didn't return to her, but she never kind of got this cookie cutter, white picket fence lifestyle that is referenced throughout the film.
Yes.
I hear it throughout the film when the girls are talking about, oh, yeah, I'm going to get married someday. Like, duh. It's a given. However, I feel like this generation of children represent, they have all these options. And I actually read their characterization, their archetypes, a little differently than you, that the fact that someone could be kung fu and the fact that somebody could be prof and somebody could be fantasy kind of dismisses the homogeneity that defined Japanese women prior to the war. I kind of saw these women as the new guard.
Oh, I think absolutely they're the new guard.
Oh.
I think what happens for me in my reading of this film is that the house, the titular house, consumes them, and then they all kind of wound up dissipating into nothingness or into drawers, and all you're left with is a possessed gorgeous who seemingly continues on with the aunt's will. And, you know, it,
she's carrying on the curse, perhaps.
Yeah, or the curse, or some kind of mythology.
Like, she didn't lose a lover, but she lost her father. So there definitely is some kind of...
Well, and what they say in the film is that she will kill any virgins that come into this house. And I think the fact that it's a house, it's a remote house, you see these girls come in, they start cleaning, they bring food, they start doing all this stuff. It is such a feminized sphere when they enter into it. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think the film's commenting on it as like, this is a bad thing that these girls go to this house and clean. And I say that because the characters seem quite happy when they're tidying and they're helping and they're making food. And it's a community. It's that sense of community that is bringing them together. And not even that can sustain them. It ultimately consumes them. It ultimately sublimates them into its own meaning, into its own curse, into its own trauma. I think one of the most important moments of the film, and a moment in the film that's pointed out by multiple people on the interwebs, that happens exactly halfway through the film, is when Gorgeous goes to the mirror and starts putting on the lipstick, and then she turns into fire.
Yeah.
And I think that is when the house begins to really make its play in terms of it's going to eat, it's going to consume, it's going to become stronger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what we see here is Gorgeous, and I think what is so interesting about the scene is the use of mirrors and the way the mirrors refract Auntie, and they turn Gorgeous into wearing a kind of more traditional Japanese bridal gown like her mother wore. And it's all these reflections just kind of foisted back on her. And they speak to a life that kind of ended so abruptly one day. So abruptly. And it's not like there isn't a sense of heritage, but it is something that seems so distant to these young girls. You know, I think no matter how close to your family you are, there is a sense of what happened. There's a sense of what happened in the past. And I think what the bomb did was, you know, amongst many terrible things, is it created this huge rift of something that can never truly be explained, something that never can be truly processed. And then you've got generations who have a bit more freedom, perhaps a bit more access to a variety of different things, and you know, an older generation who can't wrap their heads around that.
And who perhaps envy it and resent it. And I think, I think progress always has this, you know, for better and for worse. When you gain something, you lose something. When you gain rights, you lose tradition. When you gain something, you lose something else. And I feel like this film is, you know, you're never really, I never found myself especially sad for Angel. Sometimes I was just kind of like, oh, she's getting all this power. Oh, well, it's not good power. Oh, well, it's, you know, it's all very ambiguous. And I think even the fact that I'm calling her Angel, you knew her as Gorgeous. Throughout the film, they made reference to her beauty, but also her goodness. And again, this is a very superficial of all of the girls and all their traits that they are named after. Hers is perhaps the most traditional, short of perhaps sweet.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I feel like that's my big takeaway. And I love talking about a film that presents complexities without necessarily falling on either side.
So in all of this discussion, I wanted to enter in, and I feel like we've talked about this before on the podcast. Again, we're heading into 7 years, guys, so we might be repeating some
stuff. Holy shit, you're
right. But I think we always apply theories to different films in different ways. So here we go. Sigmund Freud.
Bum, bum, blah. A cigar is always a dick.
That and his theory of the uncanny. So for Freud, the uncanny is, quote, belonging to all that is terrible and to all that arouses dread and creeping horror. end quote. He gets into doubling in this theory. He gets into the narcissism of the child, and that the uncanny happens when a child creates multiple projections of themselves, which is then dropped when the child matures and they become themselves or a young adult. And they're like, okay, no more fantasy. I'm who I am, and this is what I like, and this is what I do. But the uncanny comes into play when the child runs into versions of themselves that they created as a child, causing fear and the uncanny. So it is creating the unfamiliar in the familiar or vice versa. So when you're a child, you think of all these things. You think, I could be this, I could be that, I could play, I could do whatever the fuck. And then you, of course, you know, make choices and you mature and you become an adult. And then you see, if you start seeing versions of yourself, either reflected through other people, through other incidences, through choices you've made in your life, they can be really fearful because they bring you back to a time when you actually had choices. And for Freud, this was really an imagined world that is separated from our own world. And for him, essentially, when the child is, you know, doing all these projections and thinking creatively, this represents an immortality. Mm. When these projections come back to the adult or us as adults, they're actually a harbinger of death. They represent all the things we are not, all the things we could have been, all the things we should have been. And they, you know, the walls start closing in around us. He actually talks quite a bit about the uncanny in terms of something like a fairy tale. So he mentioned Snow White in it. So hearing the story of Snow White, and she almost basically dies or just lies there in a coma, and then a kiss wakes her up. But you don't question that when you're a kid because you're like, oh, yeah, of course, true love's kiss wakes her up. Yeah. When in reality, that is, holy shit, the uncanny. He also talks about dismembered limbs as part of the uncanny. So it's the notion of seeing part of something that is familiar, so i.e. seeing an arm or a leg, and not seeing it as part of a whole. There is something disassociated with it that feels really disturbing and really unnatural. Maybe even if it isn't bloody and gory, you're just seeing something that should be attached to other things that you know that isn't.
Yeah. So it's totally the case in the film where they're not even, it's almost like doll parts. It's almost like, here's a torso, here's a stomach.
I mean, you look at what happens to Melody. She's getting eaten by this piano, and it's very, like, it's funny, but it's also fucked up. Like, the second or third or fourth time you see this film, because you're like, oh, this is what's actually happening. Anyway, I thought Freud is a really interesting, I mean, I don't agree with him in many, 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 many ways.
Oh, no?
No,
you don't have penis envy?
I sadly do not have penis envy.
I don't have penis envy. I envy your fucking privilege, not your dick.
But I think for Freud, you know, the uncanny, this notion of doubling within the uncanny is in some ways separate from the self. But the self acts on its own after the physical body has been destroyed, that there is a sense that this will go on and on and on, and that there is a kind of metaphysical element to it that I think is really interesting. And I think when we think of House and the uncanny, we are taking all these familiar things, we are taking these notions, these narratives, these characters, these archetypes, and just flipping them and separating them and pulling them apart and then pushing them back together. And it creates something that I think shocks us, intrigues us. It creates this sense of something that is quote-unquote unnatural. But it is because I think we are so circumscribed to one set of being and one set of ways of doing things. And I think House challenges us to see what happens to us when things are pulled apart, either literally or physically.
Cinematically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. I remember the first time I heard the word uncanny, it was with regard to the X-Men, the uncanny X-Men.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, uncanny means having of superpowers.
Kind of.
But there's more to it than that. And, this film is uncanny as all
fuck. You know, I think if you look at these young girls, as we were talking about, as kind of representing all the options out there to young women, to the aunt, they represent a harbinger of doom. They were the things she could never be because she died.
Because she died. Because she never got the chance. Because she was circumscribed to the role of wife and mother, and when that was denied her, there was nothing left. That was how I took it.
Yeah. Have fun calling this a horror comedy now, guys.
Who called it a horror comedy?
Lots of people.
It was pretty funny.
There's funny bits.
I mean, there's no way a severed head biting a bum is like, and it's that childish humor that you're like, what? And I think that's the kind of the first instance of horror in this entire film. But I feel like this film could be enjoyed on its more serious merits and just enjoyed just for fun.
Yeah. You want to talk about curses?
You want to talk about curses?
Yeah.
I would like to understand Japanese curses. I do not, but I would like to. The research that I did mostly had to do with J-horror, and I feel like I should specify that J-horror doesn't refer to Japanese horror across the board. J-horror is a very specific movement. Alex was talking earlier about a slump in the entertainment industry. Well, not the entertainment industry, in the film industry in what, like the 60s, 70s type thing?
Oh, no, in the 70s.
Yeah. In the 70s. And that's because of TV. According to my research, TV was really big, and so cinema got really weird. It got really sexual. It got really violent. It was basically just focusing on the stuff that you could not see on your TV. And, you know, Houseu kind of fits with that in a certain way. Later on, J-horror came to define, you know, a period in the late 90s, early aughts, which is where Japanese horror was taking on a lot of its own urban legends, a lot of its own stuff. And America was like, hi, hello, how are you? I would like to mine these murky depths of this well in Ringu. And, you know, I found something really interesting, and I couldn't wait to tell you that the year that Gore Verbinski's movie came out, apparently in Japan they had a memorial service for Samura.
Aww.
Yeah, they were just like, you know, we're sharing it, but we're also losing a piece of it, so let's all say goodbye. So, I did a little bit of research about, it seems to me, that there is a lot of Japanese horror involving jilted women who are in a very vengeful, retributive state of mind. Mm-hmm. And we've covered Audition on this podcast. We've covered The Ring on this podcast. I've come across all these urban legends in Japan involving women and involving, you know, women's oppression and women fighting back against that oppression and just like visiting that wrath on the innocent or on the next generation or whoever else crosses their path. An interesting one I found was about the 1932 Shirokiya department store. Have you heard this?
No.
This is an urban legend about a department store in Tokyo that burned, and female salespeople were wearing kimonos, and they refused to jump to safety because traditionally you didn't wear underwear with kimonos. And so if they jumped to the safety nets, someone might see their stuff. So they motherfucking burned alive. And yeah, like this is fertile ground for a horror movie about women so oppressed by, you know, these standards that rather than flash their vertical smile would rather burn alive. Have you never heard vertical smile before?
No!
Fuck, man! Have you ever heard of the Kuchisaki Onna?
I feel like I'm about to.
The slit-mouthed woman.
Oh, I saw that movie!
Is there a movie?
Yeah.
Okay. So apparently her deal is she wears a mask and she comes up to you and she asks you if she's beautiful.
Yes.
And if you answer yes, she shows her mutilated face and asks again. And if you answer yes again, she'll give you a similar cut across the mouth so you can be beautiful like her. If you answer no or scream, she'll kill you. And the only option is indifference, which is supposed to confuse her and let you get away.
Ooh, hot tip.
Yes, hot tip. If you come across the Kuchisana Ona, just be real blasé about it. And then also the Tiki-Tiki, the ghost of a girl who loses her legs in a subway accident. Have you heard this one?
No.
She loses her legs in a subway accident, so she chases people on her hands and elbows in search of victims, and that's apparently where teke-teke, that's the sound she makes when she's crawling, and she's in search of victims to cut in half, because she got cut in half, you know? And so the common thread in all of these legends are vengeance and revenge, and I've been wronged, and now you fucking too will be wronged. And I'm all about that.
Yeah. Oh, we're vengeful bitches.
We're vengeful bitches, but I've yet to fully understand why Japan in particular has this curse mythology with regard to vengeful women that the West and that other regions don't necessarily have.
Well, I think in all of the J-horror I've seen and the stuff I've read about, is there is a certain freedom in death, a certain ability that you don't get when you're alive.
Well, there's a lack of fucks to give. That much is for
sure.
Yeah,
definitely a lack of fucks. But also, you know, you can fuck shit up if you want. And, you know, I think there is something very subversive about that in terms of Japanese ghost stories. And, you know, when I think of J-horror, I think of people being wronged. And the mystery that you have to unravel is how this person was wronged. And why are they coming after me? Why are they coming after my husband? Why are they coming after whoever? Specifically, what happened to them? So you are always forced to unravel this history that has to do with them. Generally, it consumes the main characters and they're fucked. But I think there's something really interesting about death. And because, you know, in Japanese culture, there's a real belief in the power of ancestors and in the respect of ancestors.
Yes.
And there are altars in the home. There's the Bon Festival, which celebrates spirits coming back to the home for like one or two nights of the year. And everyone kind of gathers to hopefully feel their ancestor spirits visit upon them. And, you know, I think these female ghosts in particular represent the women who are forgotten, the women who are disregarded, the women who are not part of these familial stables, who do not necessarily have the altars dedicated to them. So I kind of see, and again, we are not necessarily coming at this with experts, but to spitball, I think it's like becoming a witch. You know, it's becoming something other. And, you know, they say in this film, you know, any old cat can close the door, but a witch cat can open doors.
Yeah.
And I think there is something really interesting about that. And I've been puzzling over that for
yeah.
a while. But I think there is something about this kind of female power that is unrealized in life, that is strangely barriered in the afterlife, depending on their death, that causes things to happen.
Okay. I see what you're saying. I think, yeah, the allegory to the witch is really interesting. What I tend to glean from these Japanese curses is that women only have power once they're dead, that women have to die and women have to suffer in order to kind of gain that power to right those wrongs, which to me on the surface kind of sucks. But when you put it in the context of the witch, it's kind of like it's reclaiming the ancestors who have suffered.
It's a rejection.
It's a rejection of their persecution.
Yeah. So ultimately for me with this film, and I thought a lot about this, you know, thinking about a witch cat, and cats are, you know, really interesting in Japanese culture.
Let's talk about cats.
Yeah. If you guys follow me on Instagram, you guys know how much I love cats. But there are the beckoning cats, you know, the cats who have the paw that goes up and down and
yes.
provide good luck. You see them all the time because they're good luck and they're really cool and beautiful, and I love them. But there's actually, you know, a whole subset of cats in Japanese culture called kaibyos, or strange cats, and they were once normal cats who are transformed into something else after leading very long lives. And then there's a sub, there are, of course, multiple subsets of the kaibo, and there's one called the bakamono, and that is a transforming monster cat.
Holy shit.
Yep.
I feel like I fucked up without researching Japanese cats.
Well, I don't know if you fucked up so much as you're missing out. But we're going back to this notion of a witch cat that can open doors, and Blanche, the cat who's kind of transforming, and the
Snowball.
Eyes. All right. The eyes are flashing. All it's doing all this shit. And, you know, is it a monster? Is it the thing? Is it the power source of the house? Why is it this white, long-haired cat? But I go back to what the characters say throughout the film, which is any old cat can open a door, only a witch cat can close doors. And for me, as we talked about this film, I think where I land with it has to do with youth and duty. And I think it opens a door to the anxiety of the female experience, the rage, the uncertainty, and so much more that comes with being a young woman. And it closes the door to the ghost of promise, to the ghost of possibility. Mm. And it brings in the terror of being forgotten.
Yeah.
And I think that's where ultimately all these characters have to live now. And I think this film does it in such an interesting way, in such an absurd way, that I think even if you're not going as in depth as we are right now, when you watch it, you kind of see these female archetypes and you see these women interact with each other and you go, this is really silly. This is funny. I'm laughing at it because we should, I don't know if we should, but we are laughing at stereotypical female roles because no one person should be subscribed to one way of living. Mm-hmm. People should be allowed to be who they are, how they want, and go forth. Mm-hmm. And I think House presents the silliness of being confined to various ideals. It presents the trauma of a generation who are unable to communicate it to a new generation.
Well, we've talked about how horror and comedy are kiss and cousins, and often they are two sides to a coin that helps the bitter pill go down. I tend to prefer horror, and I maintain that Houseu is a horror movie. But when it gets absurd, it's simply to impart, I think, really deep stuff in a way that lets your guard down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just really oversimplifies things.
Spoonful of sugar helps exactly. The medicine go down.
That's horror to me. Well, guys, that's it. That's all I've got.
That's all I've got.
That's all I've got.
We
and
took
more.
A full tour of the house. It was an open house. We saw the realtor. We went around and we did it.
Yeah.
But that is to say, I think this film is a really open-ended film. I think there's so many different ways into it.
I feel like this is an open-ended discussion. I hope we do some more J-horror in the coming years and talk more about this.
I think we will. You know, they produce such incredible films and genre films that I think we'll be coming back to them for a long time. So we hope you've enjoyed this episode. In our reminders, Salem, that's coming up. Hopefully you can make it. If you are interested, get your tickets now.
Mm-hmm. And even if you can make it, your homework remains the same. We are talking in Salem about Under the Skin. And that is going to be our episode for October. After we do the live episode, we are going to record it. We are going to post it. If you're there, you can experience it live. Otherwise, still do your homework and join us for that episode because it's going to be good.
It's going to be a good one. And of course, as we mentioned off the top, Patreon. We are new to it. It is something we are delving into. All of our tiers have to do with stuff that you guys have suggested that we've been asked to do over the years, and now we're starting to find time to do it. And
we want to give it back to you, is the bottom line. Like, we would have done this years ago if we thought we had the time, but we had to get to a place where we had to outsource certain duties, and anyway.
We're getting there. And we're going to produce some more content, and the content that you guys will support us in being able to do it and being able to do all that really good stuff that we need to do in order to create great content. But of course, we're still here. You're still Faculty of Horror.
Always.
We're still on your feed.
Yep.
Don't you worry. We are not going anywhere.
Once a month, free of charge.
Free of charge, except for August. We take that off. So, while any old cat can open a door, only a witch cat can say,
wow.
Office hours are closed.